Thinking Basketball Podcast. My name is Ben, and for those of you who don't know, Cody is he's out of the driver's seat this week. His baby came. He's staying up all night trying to match being a dad now and watching basketball. And so the co-hosts of, what do we call this show? Thinking NBA Spaces on Twitter, something like that. My co-hosts have been nice enough to stop by from that show and fill in the hot seat this week. Mo DeKeel from The Athletic, former video coordinator of many places in the NBA, and John Schumann, NBA senior writer at NBA.com. John, I think you said before we recorded 19 years you've been doing this? Yeah. 19
amazing.
Years.
So amazing.
I appreciate you guys coming in on short notice and pinch hitting and hopefully, you know, having a fun time. Well, I don't know what we're going to talk about today, but maybe basketball.
I thought we were here for badminton. I have so many badminton takes lined up and ready to go.
I'm excited. Can I say it? First time, long time?
First time, long time? Yeah. Wow. Wow. Yeah. If I could ever figure out how to get like a call-in operation going, I think it would be a dream of mine to hear first time, long time. But I mean, John, you just took care of that. So
you're making dreams come true, John. That's what you do. That's why you've been in the game for 19 years.
I'm in the New York area, so I am a longtime listener of the classic sports talk show, the Mike and the Bad Dog show. So that is a, you know, I've always wanted to, in addition to Ben always wanting to hear it, I've always wanted to say it, you know.
Ooh.
First time caller, long time listener.
So if you aren't familiar with our Thinking NBA Spaces collaboration, it's pretty fun. We get coaches from around the league to come in and talk about all kinds of cool stuff. And last week's show, we had Charles Lee, assistant of the Boston Celtics, who seems like he's probably going to be a head coach pretty soon in the league. You guys feel that? What do you guys think?
I think this year he was either had the most votes or tied for the most votes when I do the GM survey in the preseason, and they have who's the best assistant coach in the league is one of the questions. And the last couple of years, he's been at or near the top of the list.
Yeah, he was.
He'll certainly get a shot. I don't know. I mean, probably another podcast for another time, but like, I don't know how many opportunities there'll be this year. We'll see. I don't know if we're going to have a high turnover as we've had in the past. So, but he'll definitely get a lot of looks.
Okay. So this had me thinking about coaches these days who have been successful. I mean, Doc Rivers just coming in and filling in Milwaukee. I don't know if you guys have like general thoughts about that offense and Doc taking over and what has to happen. But B, just all this stuff has been swirling around in my head, and I've been thinking, are more of the really successful kind of sexy superstar coaches coming from a different lineage these days than in the past? It seems like most of the sort of steps to become a coach were you're a good player or you're a kind of a veteran player. You get into coaching, and we've even had big names sort of quote unquote cut the line, to borrow Steve Nash's phrase. Steve Nash in Brooklyn, Chauncey Billups to Portland are recent examples of like just retired players who have become coaches. I don't know. I wanted to throw that out there at you guys. It feels like the Brad Stevens, Mark Dagnall, Eric Spoelstra from the film room, Will Hardy. I mean, we could just keep going on and on. It feels like there's sort of a new generation of coaching background these days.
I think it's cyclical. I think it's something that kind of just goes, you know, ebbs and flows with it. And how many, how many players kind of jump into it. And, you know, I don't know if we're going to see a lot of head coaches with no experience, you know, former players with no experience kind of get a opportunity. I think we're going to start to see more it go back to they got to work their way at least a couple of years as an assistant before really kind of getting that. I think there's, you know, the last couple have not been great, you know, with Chauncey, with the Steven Nash experiment, although I don't think he was a bad coach. I think he was just put in a very impossible situation. But then look at Derek Fisher and whatnot. I think you're kind of seeing a little bit of a struggle. And then you're seeing, like you've listed off guys right off the top of your head that have been successful right off the bat that don't have former player experience. And I think that's kind of an important thing to monitor, but I think it's just going to ebb and flow with it. I think it's what's the situation in terms of what's the candidate pool look like. I think that's always my thing. When anybody wants to fire their coach or a fan says that, I'm like, all right, who are you hiring? Because that's just as important as, you know, if you're going to fire your coach. And right now, I don't know if there's a lot in the pool in terms of former players.
Yeah, I think it's just, I don't know. I mean, I do see your point, Ben. I think it does sort of trend. I think we are trending a little bit more to non-players. But I think it's also just a case-by-case basis. Like, there are former players who've been really good coaches. Larry Bird is one of the best players in the world ever and was a really good coach. And then there's some that aren't. I would go back to the GM survey. The one player who's gotten the most votes over the years as a who will be the best head coach someday is Chris Paul. And I've personally asked Chris Paul, do you want to be a coach? And the answer is absolutely not. And so I think it's a mentality. Like, do you want to actually go from being a player to then staying in the grind? Really, a different kind of grind, more mental and less physical, but it's still a grind to be a full-time coach for, you know, in the NBA over 9 months, right? Like, that's tough. And I think you see a lot of young guys in the league, whether they're just across the league now, whether they're player development guys, film guys, who are really eager and really want to do this and really want to be head coaches someday. So I think that pool is always going to be there. I think the player pool is more shallow, actually. You know, it sounds weird, but I think the player pool of potential head coaches is probably a lot more shallow than the pool of non-players.
Yeah, and I would just chime in. I'm not sure if Chris Paul would make a great basketball coach. And that's not a shout out Chris's knowledge. I just, you know, there's a lot more that goes into it than just the basketball.
Exactly. Yeah. I figured, Mo, you could also speak to, when we were talking to Charles last week, for those who missed it, like, we asked him what his day was like. And by the time you get to like 3 or 4 o'clock, you're like, man, do you sleep? Because his game day, he gets up at 6:30. He does the personal workouts with Drew Holiday. They have multiple coaches meetings. They're prepping for a game. They have specific scouts. I think the guy has to eat and exercise himself. I mean, that just doesn't even get you to 5 o'clock. And then, as you guys know, like, any game cycle, 4:30, 5 o'clock for a 7:30 tip off. And then you're like done and leaving the arena hours later. You know, that's a long day. That's like a 15, 16 hour day.
Game days can be brutal. I mean, there's a lull in game days that it's kind of like a 2 hour sort of window, usually around like 1 to 3, where there's really nothing going on in that moment. And I think that's when you get to do whatever it is, work out, you know, go find a snack or do that stuff. You know, it's that little break right there is your one break for the rest of the day. Cause a lot of times you have to be at the arena early. You have to be ready for the players to come in and do all that workout stuff. For me, I chose to nap. That was always my nap window. Was get a snack and nap and then, you know, head over to Staples. But I think that's the challenge in terms of coaches in general. It's just such a long day with everything. You know, the players get to come in for shoot around, leave, and then go to the game for their and be ready on the court at their proper time.
That's what is so amazing about Doc Rivers is like the dude has never had a break. Like, I remember when he parted ways with the Clippers. Was he fired by the Clippers? I don't know where his contract was. And then like a week later, he was hired by the Sixers. And I was like, wait, you've coached every year for like the last 20 years. Like, don't you want like a season off to just chill and hang out and go to Europe or something like that and just watch basketball casually? It's amazing. And then he got that chance this year, and then nope, I'm going right. He's diving right back in.
Because they can't relax like us. Like, John, you think just going to sit back and watch the game and like whatever, like a fan and hang out and chill. They don't have that in him. You know,
I remember seeing Tom Thibodeau at the Sloan Conference the one season, like he wasn't a coach. He looked great. He looked awesome. Like, he was in such good spirits.
Oh, I'm sure. But he also had a crap ton of notes, I'm sure, with him. He had a whole bunch of film. You know, I've done it. I'm sure you've had you know, former coaches reach out to you with questions about stats and things like that. They're constantly thinking and working. I mean, don't get me wrong. Doc was definitely enjoying the golf course a lot, you know, before he took this Bucks job, that break he had in between. He's on the course a lot, but it's a desire, like it's the need to compete, I think, with these dudes sometimes. That's insane. It doesn't allow them to relax the way we would normally relax.
Like a midday nap, for instance.
Yeah. Naps are so good. Don't get me started.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, let's change gears a little bit here, because another thing that's kind of hallmark of this season, it feels to me, is all these like movers and shakers. You know, 20 games go by, all of a sudden some team gets really hot and comes out of nowhere. John, you do the power rankings for NBA.com. You must be feeling this. All the teams on hot streaks. The Jazz won 17 of 21 at one point. The Knicks are on a similar run. The Cavs, I think, are 18 and 4 in their last 22, something like that. The Suns have gone from 500 to now, I think they're, what are they, about 10 games over 500 as we record this? So, first of all, can you guys remember a season with so many teams just sort of spiking out of nowhere and the standings having this kind of oscillation or volatility without necessarily the same level of like parity? It's not just like everyone's jammed together. It's like, oh, this 8 seed all of a sudden wins 17 of 20, so now they're the 3 seed.
Yeah, last season was definitely a season of parity, right? Like, wasn't there just a bunch of teams that were within 2 games of 500 for a long time? This season is definitely different. I don't know. I have a terrible memory, like, remembering seasons like this, but I can't remember it. One team you haven't mentioned is the Kings, have won, six out of seven. They're 5-1 on their road trip. And as we speak, they're about to play Cleveland to finish their road trip. So which should be a fun little matchup of rested teams that are both playing well. I can't remember it. And it's fun. Like, it's like we have the sort of the bottom part of the league. But yeah, it's fun to see like teams go from not so great. Like even the Hawks are sort of showing some signs of life, which is nice. So it's nice to see like teams go for not so great and to good. And I guess maybe it's just the way it is with an 82 game season, where you're going to have highs and lows and no team is just going to be consistently good or consistently decent. You know, teams are going to go up and down. So, I mean, I can't remember a season like this. It's definitely different than last year, where it just felt like there were just so many teams just hanging around 500 for like 75% of the season.
Yeah, I mean, this season is kind of weird in the sense of like this team gets hot early, then another team gets up hot early. Like Cleveland's kind of a great example of it, where they're, you know, 12 and 13 during that, you know, the start of the season. Garland goes out for a long period of time. Mobley goes out for a long period of time. I mean, normally like, okay, they're screwed. They've lost two of their top four guys and now they're third in the East. Like it's a situation where you're just kind of watching it sort of, it's almost like a basketball game, how we say games are a game of runs. It's like teams are making random runs throughout the course of the season in a way that's a little bit something that we're not used to. And it's hard to kind of project it. Like the saying used to be, like, you knew where the season was going to kind of end after the first 20 games. with the standings. I don't think that's the case anymore. I think teams are figuring things out and finding a rhythm and get hot at the right time. I mean, the Knicks have exploded at this point. I think there's just so many different teams that have the capability of putting a good stretch together. And I think part of it, too, is it's a good number of teams they get to beat up on that aren't very good.
Right,
and I think
that's
a big part of it as well in that sense. But I think it creates a lot of that sort of volatility in the standings.
Okay, so let's dive in on Cleveland because they fascinate me. I go to scout them. I go to catch up on them. And there are a few really cool games there that we can talk about where you might have some signal through the noise. But half of the games, especially with these home and home or the two games in a row against the same team, you're like, okay, so you beat Portland a couple times. That's cool. All right, you beat the Pistons like three times. I don't even remember if Cleveland played the Pistons three times in this run. But, John, you must feel this. Like, you get a lot of these teams. I don't think there have been five teams this poor in poor differential in the same season before, at least that I can think of. We'll try to look that up before we get out of here and double check. But like, it's not one or two teams. It's not an expansion team or two inflating the standings. It's confounded with what Mo said. Like, when a lot of teams are making runs, the Knicks make a trade. The chemistry changes. Now they're hot. What does it mean when you get five or six wins in a row against like the Blazers or some other sort of bottom team that's just not going to pick up the Spurs? They're just not going to pick up many wins throughout the season. Start with the Cavs. Like, what do we make of them based on that?
I think they got last Monday, they got like a legit win over the Clippers. They beat the Clippers. It wasn't too fluky. They didn't shoot like super well from 3-point range. I think Isaac Okoro missed 3 for 4, but that maybe was offset by Donovan Mitchell, who's like 2 for 10 or something like that. So yeah, you're constantly sort of searching for the games between good teams where both teams are healthy and both teams are rested. And unfortunately, those games are few and far between because of the schedule. Even this year, there's just a little bit more games where one team is rested and the other isn't, you know, because they put the in-season tournament in. It just created a couple of more open days in that tournament week that then sort of squeezed the schedule just like a half a degree more in every other week. So yeah, you're constantly searching for those good games. And like even Cleveland, so like that game over the Clippers, I think that was with Mobley, but without Garland. It was before Garland had come back.
Right.
Yep. Yep.
So I think they continue to be sort of like under the microscope because both those guys have played three games as we speak, coming back from injury, but only two of them were together. Like Mobley came back and then missed a game. Garland came back. So they've played two games with their full like starting lineup together, and that lineup has played 18 total minutes in those two games. And those two games were against the Pistons and the Spurs. And the starting lineup outscored the Pistons and Spurs by one single point in those 18 minutes. Small sample size, doesn't really matter. So like, let's continue to like, you're sort of continuing. And like, as we speak, they have Sacramento who's playing really well right now. So that's a sort of a, all right, circle this game. Let's all watch this game between two good teams playing well, rested and healthy.
Yeah. It's hard in the way the schedule kind of lines up to feel like you get a great gauge of these teams. I just try to kind of look at the fact that they don't have a ton of wins against the good teams that we would say, you know, like when you just go to the extended standings, just on that above 500, they're 10-14. Like, it's not, you know, they're beating the crap out of all the bad teams. And I think that's that stretch where they've gone on this run. They did that. I looked at it while you were talking. It's like Washington a couple of times, San Antonio, Detroit. It's, you know, it's beating up on teams that are in a, you know, situation where they're not trying to win. And I think it's hard to kind of figure out, okay, is this real or not? Because sometimes that can propel you into like, all right, we're ready to roll. Like, we might see them surge even beyond that and start taking on some of these tougher teams as they get down the stretch of the schedule because of what they learned in that. But the big part is, and that's what John kind of threw out there, with just when they have their actual starting lineup together, and it was a small sample size against a bad team, but to be just plus 1 point, that's the concern, right? Like, that's what you look at and you're like, all right, we're back to, does Donovan Mitchell work with Darius Garland? Does Mobley work with Allen? Like, you're back to the same old questions that we had 20 games ago. And I think that's going to be the thing that we got to parse out in the second half of the season.
Okay. Well, I want to
say, one thing, taking care of business against bad teams is better than not taking care of business.
For sure.
It's a predictor. It's an indicator that like things are going well. And I want to actually come back and ask you guys about the lineup and some of the more specific stuff with the Cavs, because I have been catching up on them this week quite a bit. Interestingly, when you go pull up, what did you say? They were 10-14 against top teams. Okay, so on our board,
500 and above,
right? So on our board for Patreon subscribers, patreon.com/thinkingbasketball, we track versus top 10 teams by net rating. The Cavs against the top 10 are plus 0.6. And you may think, when you hear that, you may think like that is okay. That's actually the sixth best net rating against top 10 teams in the league. And so like 10-14, maybe above 500, maybe that's not that great. But you look in the last month, they have a plus 14 net rating in the last month. And trying to like parse out how much of that is beating the Wizards by 30? How good is it to beat the Wizards by 30? And how much of that is, you know, the Clippers as of right now have only lost one game on their Grammy road trip. And that one game is to the Cavs. The other good win they had recently was against the Bucks. I think they played two games in a row. They played them twice, right? Yeah, and they split.
They played three times in the stretch.
Okay.
And 2-1.
2-1, right. Yeah. So, I'll throw it to you guys. The place I kind of want to start is Donovan Mitchell. I have some thoughts that go back a couple seasons with what I'm seeing with him. But when you turn them on, John, like, where do you have them in your power rankings right now? Do you think there's actually something there that could elevate them to maybe that, like, hey, this team's dangerous in the playoffs all of a sudden?
I have them six. But I'll be honest with you. I'm going to let you in a little secret that where I rank teams isn't all that important. And so I put when I'm writing, I put 99% of the effort into what I'm writing about the teams and 1% of the effort into the order that they're listed. But no, I think they are legit good. Like, I think I have them higher than the Knicks, for example, just because I do think they have better wins than the Knicks do over the last month plus. You know, the Knicks are that team that, you know, they've got some good wins recently. They clobbered the Nuggets at the end of the Nuggets road trip, honestly, about a week and a half ago. But are that one of those teams that just is much, much better against bad teams than against good ones. And the Knicks have obviously had a little bit of slippage without Randall and Anunoby the last few games. So, yeah, I have them higher than the Knicks. I think they're just a little bit more legit. But at the same time, like I said, like, we haven't seen what they are supposed to be, right? Like, we haven't seen that in the last month plus. So let's see that now and see where where it falls.
It's funny because I think I'm a little bit on I have it flipped in terms of that, but they're both kind of very similar teams and they both beat the crap out of the bad teams and have had just a very okay record or just below 500 record against the good teams in that sense. For me, the question for me with them is just like, how does the offense work when you have two dominant small guards and then you have two bigs that can't really shoot? Like, how do you make that work? And then you have Max Strus as your wing player who's not shooting it well from three right now. Maybe you put in Sam Morrill there, but I don't even know if he's going to be much of a help for you as at the three. Like, it's just a hard thing to figure out offensively. You know, I think part of the reason why they went on the run that they went on wasn't just that they were playing bad teams, but it all kind of fell into place. Like, you know, you're doing your scout, Ben, on them. I'm actually going to probably write about them this week for The Athletic and going through their stuff, and I'm trying to go through those games without the two guys. And the one thing I just noticed right away was just like, man, they're running more offense. Like, they're actually running offense, and it's not just, all right, Donovan, you take it. All right, Darius, you take it. And then let's work in Mobley and Allen. And I think that's one of the things you're kind of seeing in that, like, their evolution. I'm like, why can't you do that when you have Darius back and have Mobley and whatnot? If they can kind of find a balance of that stuff and then go into ISO, I think they're in a better position offensively. I just don't know if they have that and if they're going to be able to find that in time, whereas I feel like the Knicks know who they are at this point and have that identity kind of sewn up. And I think that's also the challenge of, well, those guys were out for so many games, so now you got to figure it out.
But it also feels like when they were out, you have, to your point, like, hey, if you run a three-man set and you involve Max Strus, all of a sudden Max Strus can attack, get downhill, make a nice pass here and there. Isaac Okoro, to me, he's been much better than he was in the past. Mm-hmm. Sharper decisions, just, you know, he's a year older. The team is a year older. Dean Wade is a year older off the bench. LeVert, more offensive opportunities off the bench. All of it comes back to me to why don't they stagger, you know? Because I think the idea of Allen and Mobley having one redundancy where they can't shoot, and Evan Mobley's, just because he was out for a little while, he's still a great defender. I mean, the Clippers game, his first game back, they stuck him on Kawhi Leonard. He did a pretty good job chasing Kawhi Leonard around for the 15 or 20 minutes he was out there or whatever. But in the backcourt, then you get the redundancy with Garland and Mitchell. And I do want to get to Mitchell. We've been teasing Mitchell quite a bit. But, like, why not stagger? Why not get something like that? Because the other thing I notice, Mo and John, when I watch them in this recent run with those guys out, this team used to be built like an hourglass, right? You had the guards who were ball dominant offensively on one side of the lineup and then the two bigs on the other side. Now you turn them on and there's a bunch of wings out there. It's Dean Wade out there. It's Sam Merrill, the shooter, out there. It's Okoro out there. Max Strus, right? It's more like you've got Mitchell wings and a big Jared Allen, and he's played well. I mean, it just feels like the stagger is the way to go, because I find it hard to see how the whole thing fits together when they're all out there.
Yeah, I'd have to look and just see how much, because it's not like they took, in years past, they took Allen and Mobley off the floor together and then brought them back together. Like, they staggered them, and there were lots of minutes where one was on the floor without the other. And maybe less so with the guards. I'm not sure. Because I remember constantly monitoring, okay, how are they doing with the two bigs together versus how are they doing with one on the floor without the other? And so, yeah, I think, and maybe, you know, this period of success without Mobley and Garland just sort of makes the formula all that more clear, right? Like, Dean Wade needs to play. Like, we need that four man who can shoot and who can space the floor and allow Jared Allen to roll in the middle comfortably. And Mobley, yeah, when you're out there with Jared Allen, you're going to have to shoot better. He did make a career high three threes, I think, in San Antonio the other night. So
it was like San Diego.
It was like, when the Clippers are back. Yes.
Pardon me.
Bill Walton.
One other
here.
Thing I will say, Cavs, quick point. In that series against the Knicks last year, they got absolutely destroyed on the glass.
Yes.
Last year, they were 20th in both offensive and defensive rebounding percentage. This year, they're 13th and 11th. So slight improvement on the glass, maybe not a little bit more than slight improvement on the glass, is just another thing to sort of just keep in mind.
I would say the one thing about staggering too, though, is you have to have guys off the bench that can help you to stagger. You can't just be in a situation where, okay, we take Mobley off. Who are we putting in? I think last year, you know, Dean Wade had a lot of injuries last year. Obviously, they didn't have Strus. Okoro wasn't as good last year as he is this year. There's a lot of, you know, Sam Merrill was a guy that they didn't play. You know, I mean, we didn't have. And then simply now, even at the start of this year, he wasn't getting a lot of minutes until these guys got hurt. And then he found his way into the rotation. So now it might even be a little bit more easier to stagger if they want to. And I don't think I think it's just finding that balance. And the hard thing when you're staggering too is like, okay, who can play with Donovan when it's Donovan on the court? Okay, who can play with Darius when it's Darius's time on the court? And you know, you have to start kind of playing that game and start figuring out, okay, that's the chemistry. That's the stuff the coach has got to figure out in all of those things. I think, you know, I think he got really kind of maligned last year for the playoffs, and people were basically saying, like, you got to fire him. I thought that was way too soon of a hook people were trying to give him. I think, you know, this was just the situation of the team wasn't as deep as it is this year, and I think you're seeing some of it now kind of come to fruition. But now he's got to figure it out, because once he brings everybody back, he's got to put that whole flow together and figure out the proper rotations in that stuff, and then allow for that to, the staggering to happen the way you hope, Ben.
Okay, so I've teased it long enough. Donovan Mitchell. This is like the third consecutive middle of the season. I don't know if it's always in January or February or when it starts, but he looks amazing. He looks amazing physically. He looks a step faster than everyone. He's obviously one of the shiftiest, like, low center of gravity, sharp change of direction players. Every Cavs game I've turned on recently, he's just slicing through defenses. We did a video on him a couple years ago when he did this exact same thing in the middle of the season in his last year in Utah. And he had a very similar run at the exact point in the season last year in Cleveland. Now, both of those times when they got to the playoffs, there might have been some minor injuries. I remember he had an ankle, I think, in the last Utah series. I can't remember if he had a I think he had a tweak last year as well in the Knicks series. So maybe it's just an injury. Maybe that's it. Maybe it's just small sample and he's rolled some ankles. But, like, do you guys buy what you see? Is there a midseason thing going on with him? Can we get this in the playoffs? And if we get this in the playoffs, how good is it? Because at least from my perspective, the games I'm seeing, and it's just reminding me of, like, midseason in Utah a couple years ago, he looks unbelievable offensively. I mean, I talked about the athleticism, but the decision-making, the passing, he's got a command for the game when he gets into the paint where he's like, let me look this way, let me throw a lob, let me kick it to the corner. He had one where there was a broken play the other day. The ball came back to him, and without even thinking, he threw it behind his back to Okoro cutting on the baseline. The ball actually hit a big man's knee and still bounced to Okoro. He's like, he's playing at that level, but we really haven't seen it take off, I think, other than his scoring explosions back in the bubble a couple years ago, things like that.
That was planned, by the way, off the big man's knee.
Yeah.
It was all by design. It was all, you know. No, I feel like, I know we're going to kind of, people like to kind of poo-poo the bubble a little bit, but we've seen him do these things in the playoffs. We've seen, I mean, maybe not at this level in the midseason, but we've seen him have these runs. Like, I think he can have that run in the playoffs. It'd be interesting to see a fun game of what if it was Mike Conley, right, who missed that three in the
game seven. Yep.
It would be totally a fun what if that went in, and what's the rise, you know, what would happen between those two teams and how things kind of shake out over the future. But, like, it's there. It's there for him. I think they have that there, and I think that's something he can attain to. I feel like we've seen some of it in the playoffs. You know, the Utah teams had success to a degree in the playoffs, never going as far as everybody wanted them to, but I think it's there.
I'll say this. That bubble year, he averaged 36 on 70% true shooting. The following season, they went to the second round, and in 10 playoff games, he averaged 32 on 60% true shooting. That was two terrific postseasons in a row, offensively at least. But defense is another aspect of it. But offensively, that was two great postseasons in a row. I remember coming off that and thinking, holy cow, like, this dude is a superstar.
Memphis couldn't stop him in that series. You know, they really struggled with him. It was granted a younger Memphis team, but, like, they really struggled with them with trying to contain him. And I think that's sort of the thing there. It's there. It's just finding the right.
I mean, he has a bag, man. He has a complete bag.
So,
like,
okay.
The high gather Euro steps, like, just ridiculous. And, like, the, you know, behind the back into step back and through the legs into step back. Like, he's just, I mean, when he's on, he is on. I mean, the one game I just remember watching of him this year was the Paris game, where it's like, it felt like everybody else on the Nets and Cavs just got off the plane, but Donovan Mitchell had been, like, waiting there for a week to play that game and was just had, like, 10 times more energy and more pop than anybody else on the floor.
John, this is what, like, every mid-season game of his has looked like, if you pull up tape for the last 3 years. He just looks like he's playing at a different speed. It's like Deion Sanders versus like regular NFL players kind of thing. And this has me thinking right back to like the stagger, maybe not in the literal sense of how you do the lineups, but I'm going to say a big word around here. Heliocentric. Like, are they better off empowering him more because the passing is part of this that has come along and developed over the years? And that's what I really noticed when he's carving up teams like this. We talked about the postseason scoring in the bubble and the year after where he exploded scoring wise. And I think he had a ton of pull up threes and he's always been an underrated shooter and things like that. But if he can collapse the defense in the playoffs, if you can find a way to get the spacing that they've had, and Jared Allen, to his credit, I think Jared Allen has done a great job with these like little floaters and push shots in the middle of the paint, finishing and things like that. We know about him as a lob threat and offensive rebounder as well.
And if passer.
He can make some passes too. So yeah. If they can get that from him, is it the kind of thing where like if you put too much on Garland's plate, you actually take away a little bit of that Mitchell, that heliocentric like rhythm? Is that their best pathway to playoff offense? It's funny you guys mentioned the Knicks earlier because I thought that was a bad matchup for them last year. And you could argue maybe both teams are a little more dangerous this time around. And the question is if they met in a playoff series again, like, is it the same issue? Because I just thought the Cavs didn't have the offensive juice last season in that series, but maybe the pathway to that is more spacing and more running through Mitchell. And Mo, I know you don't want the ISO game. I don't want that either, but just let him get in there, touch the paint, and start spreading the ball that way.
Well, I guess this goes to the broader point of one of my beliefs is I don't know if you can really win in the playoffs with heliocentric basketball. I think that's just more and more. I mean, like the level of how good you have to be at heliocentric basketball come playoff time, when you get to be scouted and watched and broken down in every which way, where a team gets that opportunity to finally lock in on a specific team that they know they're going to play at least four times, I think it becomes very challenging. I think heliocentric basketball is a great way for regular season wins, but I think it really becomes a problem come playoffs for those teams that are that, because you then become predictable. All right, I just got to find a way to stymie Donovan Mitchell, which isn't easy, but I just got to find a way to slow him down 10-15%, and now their offense is going to collapse. And I think that becomes a problem for teams come playoff time. So for me, that wouldn't be the pathway. I actually enjoy the way they're playing when they run sets and run offense and then eventually end up into ISO. I'm not saying don't ISO Mitchell and don't do just straight 1-4 pick and roll and whatever and all that stuff. But like, I think there's a way to balance those two. And I think if you stay stuck in heliocentric basketball, and we know Donovan Mitchell's really good at it, then you end up like the Jazz team.
Well, I wouldn't say it's ISO heavy though, right? I wouldn't say you have to attack this from an ISO heavy perspective. I think one of the things that makes Mitchell so good, and maybe heliocentrism is the wrong word then, because I think one of the things that makes him so good is when he's away from the ball, he's an elite shooter, but he can also attack a closeout. And I think it was in the Clippers first half, because it's just fresh in my head, he's in the corner, right? And so you run an offensive set. Maybe you have a staggered screen. Maybe Strus is the ball handler. LeVert is the ball handler. The defense hugs in. You skip it to the wing. The ball hits Mitchell in the corner. Now someone's closing out at Donovan Mitchell. He up fakes, gets by, and now he's coming downhill. And it's like, this is what happens in basketball when Donovan Mitchell's in this position, at least in January and February. He's going to dunk on you. He's going to get free throws, or he's going to make a pass that's a super high value, like a drop off for the layup right there at the next help, or spray it to a shooter for a wide open three. So it doesn't have to be ISO. But I actually agree with you. I don't think you can play too much through one guy and win in the playoffs. I wonder, though, if you can do that to win a round or two in the playoffs, and maybe if that's what the Cavs team is capped at, something like that.
I'm just wondering, like, are they more prepared to deal with Mitchell being double-teamed than they were a year ago? Because I mean, we're just talking about how great an offensive player he is. Well, in the playoffs, what does that mean? That means that, like, he's going to draw two to the ball, right? Like, and I think Allen is a much better I think year by year just improves as a playmaker. We saw it in Brooklyn. I mean, I remember watching him in first couple of years in Brooklyn, and one, he couldn't finish at the rim unless there was nobody in within, you know, arm reach of him. And then two, like he wasn't a roll and kick kind of guy. Now I think he's just become a much better at that. I was just looking at their catch and shoot numbers. They're still sort of middle of the pack in catch and shoot 3-point percentage, but it's better than they were last year. Strus is hot and cold, like as much of a sort of upgrade as he was. He's still like, if we look back at that playoff run with the Heat last year, he didn't shoot all that great over that year. So that's my thinking, just when we just talking about postseason, is are they more prepared to deal with defenses taking the ball out of Mitchell's hands? Like they can, you know, and if they are, then yeah, let Donovan Mitchell cook and force defenses to then, you know, take the ball out of his hands and then therefore, and then see where we go from there. And we like what we have when that happens, when we're playing 4-on-3 and he's not involved.
I kind of just go back to that series against the Knicks. I mean, the problem was, like, every time they went into hero ball with Mitchell at the end of games, it didn't work out for them. It was pretty obvious, whereas, like, when it was in Darius Garland's hands, they actually got a good look. They didn't make them because they didn't have anybody that could make shots at that point, you know, but, like, it was, I think they got a better look in that sense. So I like, Ben, what you're describing, that's not heliocentric, like what you described, right? Like kick it to him in the corner and allow him to play against the second side. That's how they should use him. And that has to be something. And from that, that's where he's going to cook. And that just needs to be part of the puzzle piece in your offense, right? And that could be an entirely – and it's totally different, too, if it's Darius Garland breaking down the defense and kicking it out to Mitchell, because now it's even a harder closeout. Now it's more opportunities for him to kind of – attack off of that side. And I think that's more the side of it. But if it ends up a situation where it becomes kind of hero ball centric, which is what I felt like happened to them a little bit in the playoffs, was Mitchell kept trying to do it. And maybe some of it was the bravado of, like, I'm in New York, I want to do it, you know, hometown, everything like that. But I think that's a failure for them. That hurts them. And I think that's what they need to stay away from. And the more they can incorporate these guys that they're bringing back healthy into more of an offense that flows and allows them all to kind of attack, I think then we're going, like, okay, now they're a real team.
Well, they had a hard time, I think, my memory, you know, it's been a while now, my memory's starting to fade, but you would want Evan Mobley to be the short roll outlet valve when they throw two on the ball against their guards, but they had a hard time. You know, you get Mitchell the ball, Thibodeau sends two defenders to him on the sideline, and it just kills the entire possession versus opening up a 4-on-3 and getting something good. So then you say, like, I think as the series went on, JB was trying to find ways to get Mobley the ball in the middle of the court. It still wasn't what you would want. You know, okay, we lob it over the top and he catches it 5 feet outside the 3-point line. And then Evan Mobley's facing the basket and he's got to make some decisions about two or three dribbles and a lob and a kick out. It just didn't work. So I don't know. Are we moving forward with Cleveland with cautious optimism? It doesn't sound like the discussion is getting us to this place of, like, yeah, they could upset one of those teams, you know, one of those top three or four teams in the East in the second round. Whereas I feel like with the Knicks, we did a deep dive, I think last episode, on the Knicks. And, you know, your kind of takeaway when you look at the Knicks is like, they could catch. If you're Philly or Milwaukee and you're not careful, like, that's not going to be a fun series with the Knicks.
35 games left for the Cavs. I'm going to watch those 35 games pretty carefully.
No, I think, I mean, look, the way the East is kind of shaking out, like, I think there's definitely an opportunity for them to get, you know, around, you know, under their belt and get a series win. I mean, they're looking at themselves right now as a 3 seed, and depending who finishes at 6, like, it's interesting for that. I am optimistic just in the sense of, like, I am encouraged by how they're playing. You know, John made the point too. They're doing what they're supposed to do. They're beating the crap out of the bad teams. That's step one, right? And and they have a really nice win with the Clippers, and there's still a lot of season left to be played. Like, I think they can do some real interesting things with what they have, and it'll be interesting to see the progression of it. But it's all going to come down to how do you incorporate Garland and Mobley back into this and not lose the momentum you have.
Let's finish up on a fun one. So we've had all these hot teams this season. The question in my mind now, is there another team lurking with a run? I sketched out a few candidates myself, but I want to put you guys in the hot seat. Also, John, it's gotten very dark. If you're watching on YouTube, you may have noticed.
The sun has set.
What has happened? John is in the dark all of a sudden.
The sun has set in New Jersey. I'm sorry. I apologize. I'm not close enough to a light switch to adjust.
This is why Mo just stands in front of a blackboard, a basketball court blackboard.
No, I do that because last time I didn't have it up. Somebody made fun of me for my wall. So I, you know, it's an old house I'm in. So it's like, no, yours is fine. Because I had wood paneling. People thought I was a serial killer. Didn't need to deal with that.
where was I? What would this? How do I transition out of
what
serial
run? Hot
killer?
Seat, who, what hot team do we think run. Is going to be
yes,
on a run?
Yes. Is
hot
there
team
another
has
team?
The sun not set on in this. In the.
Is there you go, John? I'll ask you first. Is there another team that you think could sort of catch fire? We have 35 games left. It's been a wild season. What do you think?
I mean, my first thought was the Pacers. And the one number that pops out is Tyrese Haliburton and Pascal Siakam have played 88 minutes together so far. 88. Like, that's not much. And they have a relatively easy – I think they have one of the three or four easiest schedules going forward. I don't know, like, if they can – I guess the Sixers could continue to sink, and the Pacers could move from 6 to 5 in the East. And I don't know if there's value in that or not, but I just think that's a team that could probably be pretty good for the last 35 games or so, just because their two best players haven't really played together yet and they have an easy schedule.
Mm. I did not think of them. That is fascinating. Yeah. Mo, go ahead. What do you got?
I think you've thought of this one though, Ben. I think it's the Pelicans. You know, you look at them, they have a plus, I think, 3.5 point differential. They're sitting at 7 in the Western Conference. I think they have, it's so they're also kind of a weird team, but they have a ton of wing defenders and long, lanky guys. They have obviously Zion, which, to be honest, has been an up and down season. There are moments where he's good, and then there's moments where it's like, dude, do you even want to play? And then there's, you know, Ingram. They have a lot of stuff. CJ, like, they have a lot of talent on that roster. I think they could find a run in them, you know, and climb up in the standings and get out of the play-in tournament range. I think that's a team I look at going, like, this is a team I kind of think has a run in them to win, you know, whatever, 12 of their last 15 or something like that. I think that's a squad I'd keep an eye on.
That's a team where, like, 50 games into the season, I still don't understand quite.
Exactly,
like,
yeah.
The starting lineup still doesn't make sense to me offensively, just because it's CJ McCollum and four guys who you don't necessarily want spacing the floor. And I don't know. And defensively they've had success, but I don't know. I don't know what it is. I like when they put Trey Murphy in place of like Jones or Ingram or Williamson. But they haven't done that a lot, frankly. I can't figure that out. See, and their results make it even more difficult because they'll have some good wins followed by some
bad
rough
losses. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're a frustrating and confusing team, which might be why I'm attracted to them, because I just feel like that's my nature.
Well, they would probably be my pick as well, though. If I had to earmark one team that I think could put together one of these, like, whoa, did they go 16-4? Like, how did they, weren't they just close to 500 and now they're like third in the conference or something? Although I don't know if anyone's going to catch the big four in the West, but like, they look like a team. You mentioned CJ McCollum just in the last month. He's moved into like the top 25 in the last month in our box plus minus model at thinkingbasketball.net. Not for the season, just the last month. He's just been on fire. The shooting, the sort of, like, if you think about the peak essence of a CJ McCollum experience, he's been doing it more for the last month. The shot's been dialed in, playmaking, things like that. You mentioned Trey Murphy III. He's obviously a phenomenal shooter, attacks closeouts like a maniac, can defend. I think he's just a fascinating fit. Ingram himself is like an up and down, very interesting player where some games you get this tough shot making and this passing that you're like, man, Brandon Ingram, so you can make the all-star team. Like this is really hard to defend. This is really beautiful. And then you have other games where the shot is off and the decision-making isn't as consistent. And then of course, I think it comes back to Zion, who to his credit does look like he's in better shape. The game the other night against San Antonio was just free entertainment, or I guess how much it costs to pay for your television subscription or League Pass or whatever. But like that was unbelievable. If you guys missed that back and forth matchup with him attacking Victor Wembanyama, Wemby won a few rounds. I think Zion won the fight. He just looks a little crisper at the rim than he did 3 months ago. Looks like he's lost a little weight. And so you're like, okay, it's February, right? Does he relax at the All-Star break, or do they come out of the All-Star break, have a good schedule, have momentum, and things finally click? Because there's an abundance of talent on that roster. An abundance of talent. So, yeah, they would probably be my pick.
One other team to just throw in there to keep an eye on as a bonus pick is the Dallas Mavericks. I mean, they've only gotten 23 games together with Kyrie and Luka. If they can find a way to get them kind of healthy and get an extended run and get them both on the court at the same time, I think we might be able to see them kind of put another nice stretch together. But again, it's just hard when you're kind of looking at the injury stuff. But that'd be my second pick if I had to pick two.
Their injuries go beyond basically Kyrie's absence. Like I looked at like their top nine guys. Like first of all, like we think that their starting lineup would be Doncic, Irving, Exum, Derek Jones, and Lively. Like those five guys have barely played together. But if you even look at like their top nine guys, I looked at it like they've had no more than six of those guys in 24 of their last 32 games. They have just been, you know, we're talking about Kleba, like beyond the starters, Grant Williams. I'm forgetting it. Somebody.
Tim Hardaway.
Yeah. Like they've just been so depleted. And I don't think there's a high ceiling just because I don't believe in them defensively. Primarily,
yeah.
But it would be nice to see them, you know, have everybody together, or at least eight of those nine guys together for, you know, 10 games in a row. Like that would be nice.
Guys, here's some trivia. You know, the first guest in Thinking Basketball podcast history. Does anyone know this?
No.
It was Mo DeKeel. It was the first guest. Yes.
No.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. I'm only bringing that up because today is the 250th episode.
You started so poorly.
Yeah. I like this is actually a psychological tactic of mine. You start low. Yes. I advise this in all romantic and dating settings as well. You want to start with like a very low bar and then you'll look like you're improving quite a bit. Yeah.
Oh, man. Oh, nice. Good to know. I'm taking credit for the podcast now.
Yes, we'll send you the royalties. You'll get the check later. Thanks, guys, for coming on. I hope you enjoyed this. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you for having us.
It was great.
If you want to support us, check out patreon.com/thinkingbasketball. Otherwise, that is it for this one. We're going to try to wrangle Cody back into this seat at some point next week for our sixth, is it humanly possible, our sixth annual sub all-star team. I cannot wait to do this, the snubs and the cuts, and you guys will be so excited about the sixth annual sub all-star team that we put together. Otherwise, that is it for this one. Thanks for listening all the way through, and as always, I hope you're having a great day.